Matt Odell. How are you, sir?
How's it going? Pleasure to be
here. Good, man. Thanks for joining. I appreciate it. Loving the Citadel Dispatch logo in the background. Yeah, so as we were talking, you know, for those who don't know you, of course, I'll have information in the show notes. I'm going to get you to do a bit of an introduction so they understand sort of the breadth and depth of what you're working on. But I have thus far talked to some fantastic Bitcoiners, builders, economists, futurists, global executive consultants, you know, kind of an OG guy named Are You Serious, who was advocating for the beauty and the power of cyberspace in the 80s and 90s and got his take on what has transpired versus what he thought would. And so the conversation I'd love to have with you today, because you do span an array of not-for-profit, open-source initiatives, venture capital. You've built, you know, products of your own. You've talked and worked with a ton of builders. Is to sort of give us a sense of how we should orient our expectations with regard to freedom technology broadly, Bitcoin specifically, and ultimately what it does for us in the world, where all of us, you know, we're recording this on June 16, and there are missiles flying between Iran and Israel. Who knows, you know, what the truth is these days, but depending on the source of media. And so the point being there, what do you trust? Who do you trust? To what degree do you trust any of it? So let's start here. Give us a sense for those who don't know you outside of Bitcoiner circles, because inside they certainly will, of what are your key areas of focus?
So before I got into Bitcoin, it was more or less you could categorize myself as a disenfranchised youth. I didn't think the prospects were high for the society and the future that we've found ourselves in. And then I discovered Bitcoin. And that was in, you know, the Snowden era environment. So 2008 hit first. I was like, can't trust the finance guys. They're building up a house of cards over there and they just lie to you and pretend that they know exactly what's happening when they don't. But I was like, we could trust big tech. And then 2013 rolled around and Snowden revealed that we couldn't trust big tech and that they were in bed with corrupt federal government. And that was definitely a low point. And at the same time, I was assessing Bitcoin. And Bitcoin became this avenue of hope for me. It became a direction that we could actually affect actionable change and have control over our lives and have true agency. And further than that, it was just the greater open source movement. So Bitcoin as an open source project was kind of what brought me into open source in general and how it empowers individuals. So from that point forward, I just dove deep down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin and open source. And I tried to pick it to pieces and see where it would fail. And I came to a relatively simple conclusion. The power of these projects and the scale of these projects rely on the fact that they're software and they're tech-based. But the success of them relies on individuals. It's a movement of people. And so when you look at it from that perspective, you really come to the conclusion that the two things we need are better education and better tools. And so everything that I've focused on since then have revolved around that simple thesis, better education and better tools. And so that's really broad. I've volunteered with the Human Rights Foundation training activist for 7+ years. I co-founded Bitcoin Park in Nashville and now in Austin, which is a in-person community space focused on building and education. I co-founded OpenSats, which is a 501c3 focused on supporting open source projects. I'm one of the original partners of 1031, which we fund for-profit businesses that operate in the space. A lot of them have an open source focus. We're very proud of the fact that we invest in full stack open source businesses where other investors wouldn't. And then last but not least, I found myself semi-involved in politics and policy as one of the founding three board members of Bitcoin Policy Institute. And that came as a realization that you couldn't just ignore politics and that the early cypherpunk movement had a two-pronged strategy on one side on the tools and the education, and the other side on fighting legal battles. And that really came to head last year when privacy-focused open source devs started getting thrown in the gulags. And I was starting a family and realized that if I wanted to be a productive American and not have to look over my shoulder all the time, we needed more effective policy.
And to say nothing of, I think the education, I mean, you know, I will say in no small part are the reason I'm doing what I'm doing, based on your early podcast work. And so maybe with that, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, Matt, but your rabbit hole recap, TFTC first, I presume, these are projects that you started very early in. You weren't, quote, working in Bitcoin, perhaps, but you were educating on Bitcoin. So when did those kick off? How far back do those go?
So it's a little bit confusing, and it's often misconceived. So TFTC is Marty's project. Rabbit Hole Recap is something the two of us started together 7 years ago. A weekly show that we haven't skipped a single week. I had a child. Marty had two children. Marty's father died. We evacuated for COVID. Bitcoin fell 80%. Never skipped a week. There's always a Rabbit Hole Recap. We like to joke that Bitcoin could go to zero and there'd still be a Rabbit Hole Recap. And then I launched my own podcast, Little Dispatch, maybe 4 years ago. And that's more focused on direct education, while Rabbit Hole Recap is more focused on news and keeping up to date on the different developments around Bitcoin. Now, if you put that in perspective of my greater journey, I started being heavily focused on Bitcoin a little over a decade now. And that first 3 or 4 years, I was operating under the assumption that Bitcoin was going to be made explicitly illegal in America. And so I took OPSEC and privacy very seriously. I didn't publicly associate with Bitcoin at all. And then the 2017 fork wars happened between Bcash, Bitcoin Cash, and Bitcoin, and I became a little bit more active, but still under NIM. And then when it looked like Hillary was going to lose to Trump the first time, I basically came to the conclusion that, and this whole time I was, you know, my main money, like I was working not in Bitcoin. I was just, Bitcoin was a hobby. And then when it started to become obvious that Hillary was going to lose that 2020 election and that we were going to have Trump, I didn't think necessarily that Trump was going to be, you know, directly positive for Bitcoin, but there was enough chaos and confusion going on that I came to the simple conclusion that Bitcoin wasn't going to be made explicitly illegal for at least 4 years, as long as Trump was president. There was too many other priorities that were going on and legal battles that were being fought outside of Bitcoin, and we could fly under the radar. And at that point, I made the calculated risk to become more public with Bitcoin. And then within a year or two, I went full-time Bitcoin.
Shout out to Marty. I'm amazed that I didn't know, you know, that I made that mistake, that wasn't his project. But I know you guys have tag-teamed a lot. And so, I mean, I think what's interesting about all of that synthesized is if we do go back to 2015, so the 10 years that you've been very, very active, there's the aspect of, okay, depending upon who's in power, this thing, Bitcoin specifically, could be attacked, could be made, quote, illegal. Talk to us a bit more about what sort of footing Freedom Tech was on 10 years ago. Like what was the vibe and the outlook, and maybe what did good look like? What was a good outcome for someone to be able to reclaim privacy, control of their money? Because then, of course, I want to talk about sort of the current state of affairs, state of the union.
I mean, so 2013, it's weird. Like part of it was, you know, Snowden had just happened. And Snowden was hiding first in China and then in Russia, basically the only two countries that you could hide from the U.S. government, the long arm of the U.S. government. And those revelations, I mean, especially as a young adult, were just brutal. It was just, we had
not so young adult, they were brutal. Yeah.
We have you bagged and tagged and you have no agency over your lives. But Bitcoin was still very much in, it was very much in the shadows. It was very quiet. There were no suits involved yet. You could go on every server, no services at KYC AML. And it was very much personal responsibility. It was like the Wild West. It was completely Wild West. I mean, I remember the first Bitcoin cold storage wallet I created. I printed out a paper wallet and then I destroyed the printer because the printer might have memory. But there was no hardware wallets or seed words didn't exist yet. Like the things that people take for granted didn't exist. People were getting rugged left and right. Mt. Gox hadn't happened yet. I don't remember exactly when Mt. Gox happened. Maybe that was late 2014, but the writing was starting to get on the wall. But people were losing their money on random custodial services all the time. There was absolutely no real law enforcement involvement. Silk Road hadn't been taken out yet. It was about to be taken out. So like Coinbase didn't even exist. I think Coinbase came a little bit later. So it was a completely different environment. And I enjoyed the fact that there was just no rules and you kind of could just make your own destiny.
As much as you were now, remember, did it feel like that could continue? Or, you know, I'm asking you to rewind history, but did you guys know it was a flash point in history?
No, I think so. At that point, my conclusion, my thesis was like Bitcoin would be like black market money, and even if it was just used as a method to deposit and withdraw from online gambling sites, which were illegal back then, now they're legal. That it would have significant value. But it was hard to comprehend the true big picture. I mean, I remember thinking like $10,000 was moon math. Like it was ridiculous math. Like there was no shot. Like if that was like you would do the dream calculation. You take the stack, you multiply it by 10,000. The idea of BlackRock ETFs and Larry Fink being on CNBC talking about Bitcoin was like completely out there. Governments stacking strategic Bitcoin reserves is completely out there. And I think also there was an assumption that, a completely wrong assumption, that we could continue in the shadows as like a niche project for longer. Maybe not forever, but for longer. Now in like 2016 or so, it was when you started to see the ID requirements, the KYC AML, start getting implemented on different exchanges. And at first it was really pushed back on by the community. They said, never use it. And it was very much, you know, a massive success on the government enforcement side in that within 2 years, pretty much every service had it. And if they didn't, they were getting whack-a-moled one by one. To the point where now when someone new comes in, they just assume that's the status quo. And I would say that if you want to look at it from the positive angle, basically in a regulatory environment scenario, Bitcoin has been slowly captured and trending in the wrong direction for about 10 years, probably like 2015 to 2025, early 2025. And this is the first year that trend has tangibly reversed. Now, people shouldn't get complacent, and there's still a lot of fights to be had. But in terms of regulatory environment, it was literally a decade of just worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And then this year happened, Trump got sworn into office, and a lot of his support came from Bitcoin and the adjacent crypto community, and you started to see that get pushed back to a degree.
Was that inevitable? And specifically, do you feel like different technological or protocol design decisions could have been made to avoid that, or was that just the way it was going to go in terms of the ability now, largely, for government to not stop Bitcoin, but to control many of the aspects of its flow and usage?
I mean, I think in hindsight, it was inevitable. I think 3 years ago, even, the writing was pretty much on the wall. And you can go back. One of the cool things about Rabbit Hole Recap is it's like a time machine. Every week, you could just my unfiltered thoughts on the subject. And the haters will say I got plenty of things wrong, and I did. And the truth of the matter is I got plenty of things right. But no matter what—
If you didn't, you'd be a spook.
Exactly. No matter what, it's my unedited, unfiltered thoughts every week for the last 7 years.
Absolutely.
The strategy became relatively obvious and has been successfully executed. And I think in hindsight, it was pretty much inevitable. I mean, there was two paths we could go down. There was a path where you saw widespread attempted bans on Bitcoin throughout world governments. And in that situation, Bitcoin operates in a much smaller scale, but in the shadows. Or you see embrace and capture. And that's the trajectory we saw. And there's definitely pros and cons on both sides. But I think all said and done, if you look at it from the angle of someone who wants to see Bitcoin and these technologies being used as tools for freedom, we are probably in the best timeline. It is hard to complain about where we stand today, given all the potential trajectories that we could have went down.
Absolutely.
Continuing to look back a bit, and you mentioned Snowden, certainly speaking of flashpoints, that was a hell of a flashpoint. What else would you put alongside or close to Bitcoin in terms of impact within the freedom tech sphere broadly over these past 10 years? Does anything sort of clock in at an equivalent or a close level of importance?
I mean, it's a little bit controversial, but I think... the single biggest success has been widespread usage of Signal, the encrypted messenger.
I had a feeling you might go there. Absolutely agree.
And what's fascinating about that is not just the actual tech, which isn't perfect. It makes certain trade-offs, but gives you a reasonably secure environment that is easy to use, convenient, and has all the features people expect from a modern messenger. So you're usually, with any of these kind of tools, you're looking at a trade-off balance that reduces convenience in the sake of freedom. And Signal strikes a very solid balance that has resulted in significant usage of it. Now, one of the more fascinating parts is not necessarily the tech side. It's how the actual project was structured as a relatively sustainable, independent nonprofit. There's not really many other examples of that, definitely not at the scale of Signal, to the point where they actually are on the front lines of doing policy work. And Meredith Whitaker, their new CEO, who came out of big tech, is one of the best people to ever speak in mainstream media about the importances of privacy and free and open source software. So, I mean, I would put that project on a massive pedestal in terms of success and pushing the freedom tech movement forward. And then definitely a solid mention for Tor. Ironically, both of them got a lot of their funding early on from the US government because they had their own needs in terms of private and secure communication. But Tor has been a massively successful project. In both cases, they operate in a slightly different threat model than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is designed to be robust against a hostile U.S. hegemony. So if the largest, most powerful government in the world, the U.S. government, wanted to stop the Bitcoin network, it'd be very difficult for them to, if not impossible. But I don't like speaking in absolutes, and usually if you speak in absolutes, you're wrong. But with Signal and Tor, they operate in this middle ground threat model where they're relying on certain constitutional protections by the U.S. They fight them in courts. And if the U.S. government ever wanted to really take them out, they probably could relatively easily. It just kind of comes down to whether or not a judge would let them do it or not. I mean, Tor has not solved in a decentralized way this civil resistance problem. You could relatively easily flood that network. And Signal, I mean, it's as easy as just pulling that thing from app stores, and then 95% of users wouldn't be using it.
And that does seem to be one of the most interesting dichotomies. As you were talking about that, I thought to myself, Signal is, I think without exception, probably the most you know, so-called normie-friendly freedom tech project that I can think of. It's been pretty straightforward for me to get friends and family to use it. I would not be able to say undoubtedly the same thing about Tor. You know, A, would they understand and appreciate the need for it? B, would they be able to use it? You know, Bitcoin, you know, incredibly easy using something like Strike. If you're going to ask somebody to spin up their own Electrum server, different discussion. And it seems like Signal sort of sits there in the middle, in that it's tremendous utility, as you say, a reasonable set of trade-offs, and they've really nailed the user experience. So if we then jump, Matt, to sort of, you know, 2025, State of the Union, whether it's those projects and or others, would love to get your take, again, from the standpoint of someone who is supporting grants, who's investing via 1031, who's in constant conversation with the builders and the funders and the rest. What stands out? Like, what is going really well in 2025 in terms of freedom technology broadly?
I think it's easier to use Bitcoin than ever before, period, full stop. The negative is that the overwhelming majority of people coming into the space are coming in through regulated financial institutions that are keeping track of users and their transaction history. But with that caveat, self-custody of Bitcoin has never been easier. Spending Bitcoin or receiving Bitcoin has never been easier. The mobile app ecosystem is better than it's ever been before. The hardware wallet ecosystem is better than it's ever been before. It's easier than ever to run a Bitcoin node and use the network in a trust-minimized way without trusting third parties. So there's been overwhelming successes, and it's easy to get disenfranchised if you're in the weeds, because a lot of times these things feel like they're moving really slowly. But I mean, if you look back even 4 or 5 years ago, we've made so much progress. You'd have to be blind not to see it.
Do you think we could say the same thing about education and awareness? And what I'm thinking of specifically are the ability to use Bitcoin, but before that, the perspective or perception that Bitcoin is for criminals, Bitcoin's not for me, that if it's not KYC, it must be dodgy. You know, do you have a sort of a perspective on where we are on, you know, has there been sufficient pain in many ways for the typical individual to look at this and think, yeah, I do deserve to transact freely. I don't want, you know, the government and other parties to know everything about everything I do. What's your take there?
I mean, I think it depends who you're talking to. I've traveled around the world a lot and worked with people based in different places. And if outside of the West, outside of America specifically, it's easier for people to realize the need for an independent money and the failures of government systems than it is for Americans. And in America, what we're seeing is very much a frog boiling kind of situation that is heavily trusted, that is heavily surveilled, that's heavily controlled, and that those practices are normalized. And that's way bigger than Bitcoin itself.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you walk down any neighborhood street in America, a significant majority of the houses will have a Amazon-connected, always-recording surveillance camera outside. And so what Orwell got wrong in 1984 is that the government wasn't going to force us to install cameras. It was people were going to go out and buy the cameras themselves and pay for the privilege to be spied on.
Victims and their volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing KYC enter every aspect of our lives, once again, not just Bitcoin. It's super normalized for people to expect their phone number that's tied to their identity to be used for a service, for instance. Mm-hmm. They don't think twice about that. But at the same time, the tools exist. The tools exist for people to take agency. And I strongly believe that you can't. It's very difficult to convince someone that they need the tools if they don't actually realize themselves. And I think if you're thinking about the scarcity of time and the scarcity of energy, it's better spent focusing on improving the lives of people that seek improvement than trying to convince a large, you know, relatively masses to try and adopt something.
Yes. And I mean, I think, you know, I have often said, and I contend that Bitcoin is competing with Apple Pay in the West, right? That user experience is incredible. Now we, as you mentioned, we know what's going on behind the scenes, right? It's collect it all, analyze it all, and everything that flows downstream from that. But it is incredibly difficult, as you say, to get individuals to step away from that level of comfort. I mean, I'm, you know, side note, I'm going through trying to move to Graphene OS on a Pixel phone away from my beloved iPhone after moving off Mac last fall. And, you know, it's painful. There's some trade-offs. But ultimately, I think it is empowering. It's tremendous. I don't expect any significant percentage of the population to pursue that until they're in a situation where perhaps they must. But, well, continuing on that note, I mean, are there other projects like Signal that you think get that trade-off between tremendous utility, privacy, trust minimized, and great UX? Who else is getting that right if you see some?
I mean, you mentioned Graphene, and I wouldn't put it on the Signal level of trade-off balance, but they've made great strides in making it more convenient to access that hardened OS than it was before. I remember, I was one of the first people to flash Graphene, and now they made it relatively straightforward to take a Google phone and de-Google it and use Graphene. Now, once you're in that ecosystem, there's significant trade-offs in terms of quality of life and convenience that I just don't think exist with Signal. Like Signal, I convinced my 90-plus-year-old grandmother to install a Signal because it's the only way she gets baby pictures. She is never installing Graphene.
Incentives are aligned. Yeah.
I would say loosely, and I also wouldn't put it on the level of Signal because it's not open source. You're completely trusting it. And it doesn't offer the same security guarantees. Where Apple has moved more recently, at least narrative-wise, has been a breath of fresh air. I mean, I think you could, you know, one of the largest encrypted messengers in the world, or at least in America, is iMessage.
Yes.
Now, once again, we're trusting it because it's not open source and the security guarantees aren't as strong. But at least
the advanced protection feature, I assume you're referring to. Yeah, I think that's what they call it. Yeah,
exactly. Where you allegedly can end-to-end encrypt your cloud storage as well.
Hold
the
key.
I think, at least like narrative-wise, they're showing the case that one of the largest, most valuable companies in the world believe that privacy is a strong selling point and that customers actually care about it, which I think is an important piece of the larger picture. I'm hesitant to give Zuck any credit because I feel like it's a bit of a psyop, but the fact that WhatsApp has end-to-end encrypted messages, which once again, security guarantees aren't as good as Signal, but the number of users is way higher. Like it's like 3 billion users or something.
Outside of the West, it is de facto. Absolutely.
Yeah. Facebook, the only thing that limits Facebook user growth is the amount of kids that are born every year because they've already fully saturated the global population. So the fact that they even have shitty end-to-end encryption in WhatsApp is a massive win. But I think just to pull this all back, the question that I think people that are focused on this stuff and don't want to be don't want to get disenfranchised and frustrated about it is we have to be realistic about what a success situation looks like. What does winning look like? And I really think like winning is like 5% or higher of the global population using the tools in a freedom focused way. And I think the actionable goal here should be trying to get that number higher. But we have to operate from a realistic point of view that there's almost zero shot that we'll ever see over 90% of people using Bitcoin as freedom money, or we'll see them using secure encrypted messaging. These types of things, it tends to be some kind of curve where the very small minority is using them, but that anyone can access them at will and take agency over their lives is the key piece there. So as pain happens, as people start to realize that they need these tools, having them available to them and accessible to them is the win in my book, and not necessarily broad, widespread usage.
Well, and I think to your point, I mean, if we have better money and we have better communications, any other categories? I mean, so basically, what would be a third pillar, if anything? You know, if we fix the money through Bitcoin, we fix communications through Signal and Nostr, what's left, do you think? Where are there other areas of opportunity?
I mean, I think just they're both communication, but you can't group Nostr in with Signal because they're trying to do two different things.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. So,
I think Signal has shown us massive success. I also think the technical implementation of doing person-to-person, private, encrypted communication is much more straightforward than trying to solve the quote-unquote social media problem. You know, our world is increasingly digital. We're moving more and more towards digital IDs. Everything is surveilled. Everything is controlled. People live, you know, 60% of their lives scrolling their phones on centralized big tech platforms. I think the last big one, the last big pillar, we got the money on Bitcoin. People have the ability to use Bitcoin as freedom money. Not everyone does. Most people don't. We have the direct private communications with Signal, or you can go more hardcore with something like SimpleX, which still works quite well, strikes a different trade-off balance. Is less centralized, more secure in a lot of ways, but harder to use. So we have like the direct message side kind of at least technically sound, and the options are there. The last piece is identity, which Nostr aims to solve, and one-to-many communications, aka social media and social media S type of situations where you're broadcasting out to the world. And in that situation, you want to be able to do without permission, without centralized single points of failure, but also the last piece, which is going to be incredibly important as we continue forward, is trust minimized verifiability and authenticity and integrity, because we're going to see more and more fake news. We're going to see more and more deep fakes. And right now, the current status quo, for instance, is if you're reading something on Facebook, you are trusting that Zuck is telling you that it's coming from the person that said it and that it hasn't been changed or altered. And that's just a ridiculous premise.
The idea of a watermark now is laughable, right? I mean, that was the way of doing things is, you know, some deepfake AI has got a watermark and that's meaningless now.
Yeah,
great point. So, you know, money, one-to-one comms, identity, one-to-many comms, makes a ton of sense. If we shift then, sort of staying in kind of current state of affairs, if we shift to the builders and the businesses, talk to us a bit about OpenSats, why it exists, what you guys, Gigi and team, are doing, and ultimately why it's important.
Yeah, so I mean, with OpenSats, a few years ago, we diagnosed this problem, which is, to my earlier point, is it's easy to think of these things as tech projects, but it's a movement of individuals. It relies on people to actually build them out. And those people were just not very supported. And there was great inequality in terms of how funds were getting deployed.
Do you think, Matt, real quick, do you think that's endemic to open source? I mean, when you guys spun up OpenSats, was this, my words, not yours, was this open source funding is broken, let's go fix it? Or was this more of a microcosm of that broader open source problem?
It's a combination, right? So first of all, the reason both 1031 and OpenSats exists is because in the greater crypto ecosystem, even though Bitcoin is by far the most used, most valuable, most robust network, in terms of funds deployed both on the for-profit and nonprofit side, it was like 99-1 shitcoins versus Bitcoin funding. And so that's why both 1031 and OpenSats exist. It was to try and correct that imbalance. But also on the 1031 side, it was our opportunity. It was, that's our alpha. That's the reason we're able to get good valuations on some of the companies that will be the most profitable companies in the world, is because the funds were being deployed elsewhere. Now on the OpenSat side, it also came with the extra caveat that one of the biggest issues with foundational open source projects is that they're very hard, if not impossible, to monetize. And they're freely available to the world to be modified at will and distributed at will. And as a result, they're very difficult to monetize. And the way that a lot of that funding was happening was coming from large corporations. And you see that in the early days of the internet. You see that with Linux distros and Linux development. Corporate capture is a very real concern and a real threat. So how do you alleviate corporate capture? You don't alleviate corporate capture by going on defund the captured developers campaigns. That's just not effective. What you do is you provide more avenues of funding that are more transparent and more efficient, more aligned, and are harder to corrupt. And that's how OpenSats was born. OpenSats was born of this idea that most charities, most dev funding was coming from corporations, and that's inherently biased and becomes an issue because of broken incentives. And then those that weren't being funded that way were being funded oftentimes by charities that were not transparent, that had very centralized structures, and that were inefficient with capital, that they were using a lot of capital for administration, while OpenSats is 100% pass-through. We don't take a cut of any donations. We operate on a pure Bitcoin standard. But just to wrap up this thought, the key piece that I think a lot of people miss on OpenSats is we do fund mostly Bitcoin-focused projects. But even from the name, the whole idea is to use sats, the smallest unit of Bitcoin, to use Bitcoin to fund all sorts of open source projects. How do we throw fuel on the fire to make the open source movement more effective and accelerate the process? We do that by having 1,000 flowers bloom and really getting funding out there to open source projects. So the only caveat, the only two requirements to be funded by OpenSats are, one, you have to be an open source project, obviously. And two, you have to be willing to accept Bitcoin. But you don't necessarily have to be a Bitcoin project. We funded Tor, for instance. But they had to accept Bitcoin, otherwise they couldn't get funded by us.
And if we flip then to the fully commercial side, be it 1031, obviously where you're a partner or elsewhere, what's working commercially? You know, what are the business models and perhaps the protocols and technologies that sit at the lower layer that you're seeing success with? Like in other words, if you're speaking to a founder, a builder, perhaps a current business owner who, you know, has an inkling that they want to build in a different way on Freedom Tech, on open protocols. What's working well today commercially?
So with OpenSats, the measurement is basically freedom go up. It's, you know, will this make freedom-focused systems more robust? And is there proof of work there? On the 1031 side, you know, we have a dual mandate. Our first and primary mandate is to make money for our investors and return capital, significant appreciation. And then our second mandate is also pretty much shared with OpenSats, which is how do we make these systems more robust? Because a lot of our investors, ourselves included, have very large Bitcoin positions. And there is a nice circular feedback loop, a more robust, censorship-resistant Bitcoin protocol is strictly better for us and our Bitcoin holdings and our future freedoms. Now, because of that, it's much more difficult to effectively deploy capital. And we basically have to find kind of a balancing act. And what I've seen is, first of all, is people love hype. And this industry really loves hype. And our edge is that we mostly ignore the hype and focus on more fundamental business evaluation, which is, can this be a profitable business? Is there line of sight on an actual business model that's realistic? And then that's where we deploy the majority of our money. And then we reserve the right and have acted on it on taking smaller checks and investing it in companies that are really pushing the limit, but maybe the business model isn't so obvious or is harder to execute or will take more time to execute. And so I will give you a few examples. The business models that work really well right now are just not sexy. It's buy, sell Bitcoin is the number one product in the world. People want Bitcoin and they will pay you 1% to buy it in a reliable, trustworthy fashion. You know, they don't want to get FTX. They don't want to get BlockFi. They don't want to get Celsius or Goxed. They want a trusted company that, and it is a trusted relationship.
Certainly.
That they can rely on to buy and sell Bitcoin, and they'll happily pay a fee. And that's by far the single biggest product. The second piece also kind of goes hand in hand on that, and we're seeing a lot of demand for it right now, which is this idea of Bitcoin collateralized loans. But in both cases, what you're seeing is the strongest business model is companies that are able to sit in between the traditional financial system, your banks, and Bitcoin, and act almost as a centralized regulated translation layer between the two worlds. And Strike is our key example there. We're the largest investor in Strike. And so the way I think about that is it's where we are on the adoption curve of Bitcoin. We very much still live in a fiat world. And so that translation layer has a lot of demand and a lot of value. And a company that can execute well in that legal environment, be available in a lot of jurisdictions, be regulatory compliant, be fast, effective, and convenient to use and reliable to use, will make a significant amount of money. And Strike has been proof of that. Now, when you start to go further off on the in like the levels of adoption, you start to see stuff like Start9, which we're the largest investor of Start9, which is this idea of self-hosting everything that you host in the cloud. Let's host it at home. And it started with Bitcoin nodes, but it offers a lot more than that. For example, that's a business that is very promising. And the business model is a little bit more difficult. They sell pre-built servers, but because it's open source, you can also just flash it yourself and not pay them a dime. On your own computer, which is incredibly important from a freedom perspective. And then they want to sell premium services. But the question is like, how big is that demographic? And that
it's
not that large right now, but it could be quite large in 5 years or 10 years. And so,
and if that were to happen, I mean, I think that's worth interjecting.
Yeah.
Because I think about that often. I mean, I'm using Umbral, love Start9, but it's just what I have. And for all of them, I want them to do brilliantly, but that total addressable market is so small. What do you think, and again, this is a bit of an aside, what do you think needs to happen? If you're willing to share it, like what's the thesis, what's the dependency in order for you guys to look at that and think, yeah, we're going to get a 10X on that?
I think the number one thing is time, and you just can't force it. And that's why I think it's important to be realistic, particularly if you're responsible for investor capital on how you assess that basically liquidity premium, liquidity risk, because you're locking up funds on something that's going to take longer to build out. Valuation
Yep.
should be properly discounted as a result of that. But it's something that we can't really force. It's a time thing. I think what we're seeing is more and more of our lives are moving to the cloud, which is just someone else's computer. There's a significant mm-hmm. dependency there on not only on individuals, but also businesses. And what's going to happen is you're going to start to really, the pain points of that and the trade-offs that are being made, giving up that agency will become more and more obvious. And at that point, more and more people and businesses will look to self-host. And it's something that you can't really rush. And all you can do is just build the best product possible and build your business in a lean way so that you know, first of all, that you don't have to rely on future investments. So try and get to profitability and sustainability as quick as possible. And second of all, that it's a long grind and that it's not like, you know, the sexy words of the day is vibe coding. Like it's, you can't vibe code a generational business. Like you have to be willing to be in the trenches for 10, 20 years And you need to have investors that are aligned with you on that. And so we came at it from that perspective very early on. Our funds are all called low time preference funds. The idea is that we're going to be in the trenches with you for a while, and this is not your traditional VC enter, expect, push for an exit in 2 years, 3 years types of thing. And you just have to balance it off. Like another example would be something like Peach, which is no KYC, P2P buy sell Bitcoin. And we've seen growth there. The growth is on a way lower scale and a way lower total absolute numbers than something like Strike, which connects directly to your own bank account and is centralized and regulated. But as we start to move into a world where Bitcoin becomes more and more of this dominant reserve asset and people start really keeping their savings in Bitcoin, we expect to see more usage in something like that. And you manage the risk basically by position sizing and valuations.
What about outside your portfolio? Is any, you know, whether it's deals you looked at and think, wow, we should have, wish we hadn't passed, wish we hadn't missed that one, or just things that have, you know, taken off in the last 12 months or so? Like what else has got your attention at present?
I mean, look, the best business in the world probably right now, not just in the space, is Tether. And we are not investors in Tether. That is a very closely held business. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they're on track to make $24 billion in profit this year with like 70 employees. So it's just on a whole nother level. Now, I think even they realize exactly what I just said, which is these businesses tend to, you have to balance them into where we are in the adoption curve of Bitcoin specifically, if they're Bitcoin adjacent businesses. And so with Tether, they're basically doing this arbitrage opportunity where right now there is massive demand for dollars outside of the traditional financial system globally. I mean, I was in Argentina and the whole country runs on Tether. It's like, mm-hmm. And the individuals chose it, not the government.
Absolutely.
The individuals chose that they wanted dollars. And because the governments didn't want them to have dollars, their only option was to use something like Tether. But as Bitcoin adoption increases and Bitcoin becomes more successful, the demand for Tether should subside and should reduce. Because why would you want something that gives you dollar exposure when dollars are just strictly worse money than Bitcoin? Absolutely. And how do I know that Tether agrees with that thesis? I know they agree with that thesis because they're using their profits to, and they have over 100,000 Bitcoin stacked. And so they're positioning themselves to make as much money as possible during this adoption phase and then have a war chest of Bitcoin to either evolve and offer different types of products, which we have seen them try and do, or just kind of rest on their laurels of, you know, one of the largest Bitcoin treasuries in the world.
Stack sats, stay humble. Yeah. Well, and maybe for those who aren't familiar, talk to us a bit about, you know, well, what is Tether? And as you mentioned, it largely exists to address the, close the gap of access to dollars where dollars cannot be had. You know, like, what are the trade-offs? Talk to us about Tether and what those trade-offs are as compared to Bitcoin.
Tether's a centralized U.S. dollar token, and it's backed by U.S. Treasuries.
And they are the Tether's fifth or sixth largest U.S. Treasury holders?
I think they're lower than that, but they're still quite high.
Yeah.
And the U.S. Treasuries pay them an interest rate, and people actually, it kind of already got normalized that banks don't pass you down the majority of interest they make. Because even if you're using Citibank or whatever, they're paying you like 0.5%, which is absolutely negligible compared to what they're getting. But Tether just pays no interest to the users, and they collect that interest. So interest rates are up right now. And as a result, they're just minting money. They're making a ton of money off of those treasuries that they're holding while being able to offer these US dollar tokens in a very cheap, convenient package. Now, what is the trade-off? The trade-off is twofold. First of all, you have to trust the Tether organization. They have frozen funds before in partnership with law enforcement. You also have to trust them to maintain the reserve. There's no cryptographical way to prove real-world ownership of assets. So it's strictly a trusted relationship. we've heard for years that their Tether is not operating in a full reserve basis. I think at this point now, it's pretty obvious that they are, but you still have to trust them that is the case. They could get shut down.
Mm-hmm.
They can exit scam. They can just because a company has, 10 years of proof of work, 11 years of proof of work and reputation doesn't mean that tomorrow that doesn't change. So Bitcoin fixes these things. And then the last piece, by the way, is that it's tied to the dollar, which is incredibly corrupted and controlled, and is at the whims of people that have continuously devalued it. And over time, if you try and hold your wealth in dollars, you will lose purchasing power over time. This is just a fact. As the U.S. debt burden gets higher and higher, that printing will continue and that devaluation will continue, and it's backed by that. So you're trusting effectively two entities. You're
right.
Trusting the Tether entity, and you're trusting the U.S. government and central bank. Bitcoin fixes these things. It's money without trust. It's money that you can spend and save without permission that is very difficult, if not impossible, to block, which is very difficult to seize. You have to actually physically coerce someone 99% of the time if they're holding self-custody Bitcoin to seize Bitcoin. If they're holding it in cold storage, you have to do a physical extraction of that Bitcoin. You have to come in, put a gun to their head and be like, give me your Bitcoin. You can't even hack it through the internet right now. If you have a hot wallet, that's different. So Bitcoin solves these problems. And then last but not least, because Bitcoin is scarce and because it's incredibly hard to change by default, it is reasonably safe to assume that the supply of Bitcoin will never increase. And as a result, as adoption happens of this scarce asset, purchasing power has shown that it increases, and you should expect purchasing power to basically increase forever. Now, it's a free market. There'll be hills and valleys, and there'll be downturns. But long term, if you hold Bitcoin as your savings vehicle, you should have more purchasing power in the future. You should be able to buy more meat. You should be able to afford better schools and better houses. So Bitcoin solves all of these things that are inherently wrong with human-controlled systems and human-controlled money. But it's going to take a while, I think, for people to truly grasp that. And right now, basically, we're in this transition phase where certain business models are more effective than others. But at some point, we leave that transition phase. And what I like to categorize it as, when more people are earning Bitcoin than buying Bitcoin and more people are spending Bitcoin than selling Bitcoin, is when that phase has fully transitioned over to a Bitcoin standard phase. At that point, different business models will be effective than today. And all the little micro changes in between there are when different business models unlock. And you have to kind of measure where you are on that cycle. Otherwise, you just get lost in hype and end up burning a bunch of investor money.
Yeah, and perfect seg. I mean, my next question is, okay, if we look ahead, what are the greatest opportunities and challenges to building profitable, successful businesses on Bitcoin and open protocols? Let's put it that way.
Look, I think the number one, Bitcoin is the opportunity cost, right? So if you're a founder and you're investing one Bitcoin into your business, and one Bitcoin right now, who knows where it'll be in 2 weeks when you release this episode, but is at $108,000. The math in your head shouldn't be like, I need to make back $108,000 and then I'm in profit. The math should be, I need to make back a Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is the opportunity cost, and Bitcoin is the scarcest asset humanity has ever seen and has the highest compound annual growth rate of pretty much anything that we've ever seen. So it's quite the opportunity cost and quite the burden. So first and foremost, you need to be realistic on those expectations. Second of all, you need to be incredibly lean. You have to keep expenses very low. And this is very different than traditional tech structures. When you build a traditional tech business, you have costs balloon. You're willing to lose a lot of money very quickly for a while. And then eventually in 10 years or something, you turn on monetization. In a Bitcoin world, you need to be profitable fast. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't still prioritize growth. It just shouldn't be growth at all costs. It's reasonable growth while trying to reach profitability early. And that's profitability in Bitcoin terms. So you want to keep expenses low. You want to be profitable. And then it kind of goes hand in hand, but you need to be willing to adapt and be nimble. And so all of these things tend to benefit smaller teams with strong founders. And a lot of what we do is basically assess the founding team and see if they have the conviction and the willingness to adapt on the fly. And so we could see successful businesses that are doing one, their main business model is something today, but is completely different in 10 years. And they could be successful through the entire transition. Mm-hmm. We might see other ones that are just very successful today and have built up a Bitcoin treasury. So when they become obsoleted, there's still significant value there. Or we can see the third piece, which is a founder that is kind of in it for ideological reasons and just runs in pure survival mode, and their business model doesn't really find any kind of successes until 10 years from now. But the business has survived because it's a very small team and doesn't have money expenses and just runs, you know, very, very lean. And those are basically the three types of successful businesses you might see. And obviously, the first one is the most desirable, one that can monetize heavily today while growing, and then adapt on the fly and add new products and change their business model as we go through the transition and continue to be incredibly profitable in Bitcoin terms.
I think that's what is, you know, as an individual using Bitcoin, certainly as a business, the thing that's hardest to wrap our heads around is, what would we do if the money wasn't broken? Right? I think that's the question. Whether you're an individual, a business owner, a builder, an entrepreneur, is unlearning and relearning, how would I build a business if the money wasn't broken? Because the money is broken, you know, fiat is broken. And so if you're going to put this incredibly hard money to work, as you say, the opportunity cost is tremendous. What about any thoughts, Matt, on maybe it's an aspiration of mine. It is an aspiration of mine, but I'd like to think that we'll be able to reach, you know, I'm thinking about the CTOs, the product owners, the CXOs, the founders who have a running business, have a going concern, and they're looking around and thinking, I don't want to collect all the data. I don't want that toxic asset. I don't want that liability. I want to adapt my business to where I want things to go, where I believe things are going. So, you know, certainly there's the Bitcoin treasury approach for an existing established legacy business to adapt and adopt. Anything else that stands out? Like what do going concerns have at their disposal to, you know, to shift this and basically allow their customers, their users to regain agency and trust?
You know, I think, first of all, on the Bitcoin treasury piece, obviously, that's the topic du jour right now, and people are very excited about it. And the reason is quite simple. You can make a lot of money very quickly.
Absolutely.
And it's a very high time preference. You could argue that maybe there's a low time preference aspect to it, that you know Bitcoin is scarce, and you want as much Bitcoin as possible before other people realize. But when you're talking about adoption cycle transitions, you know, that is probably I don't even know if you'd call it a business model, but that is probably a business model that will be relatively short-lived. I don't pretend to know how long that, it's basically an arbitrage opportunity on fiat in this transition period.
And so short-lived because it will become painfully obvious and everyone will do it, or for other reasons?
Well, basically, instead of giving cheap long-term debt to another company, to a company to buy Bitcoin, you will buy Bitcoin.
Right.
Because that is actually the logical, prudent move to make. Like, I would never personally, as a capital allocator, lend money to MicroStrategy. I would rather buy the Bitcoin myself. Now, there's trillions of dollars of capital that he might be able to unlock before people come to that conclusion. But at some point, people are going to come to that conclusion and realize that they are actually failing the fiduciary responsibility of their investors or whoever their stakeholders are by facilitating that type of arrangement, or buying stock where they are then getting diluted and then buying Bitcoin with it.
They're better off their future buying, just in a different way.
Yeah, they're better off just buying the Bitcoin directly. So what does that look like? Is that a 3-year thing? Is that a 5-year thing? I don't know. Maybe the heavyweights like MicroStrategy can get away with it longer. I mean, it was quite clever, the new preferred shared offerings that he's put out there, that is trying to tap into the existing bond market.
The infinite money gap.
That's the thing. It's not infinite because Bitcoin's scarce. So the question is, when does that clock stop? It will stop at some point. Now, what I think is more actionable for people, because I don't really think an actionable takeaway is, you know, go create a leveraged Bitcoin equity play and try and tap into global financial markets. I think it's harder for some people will find massive success in it. A lot of people won't. There's a time limit on it. Is try and just have ethical, profitable business models. Now, the big problem here is it is the harder path.
Yes.
It is by far the harder path. If you want the easy path is offering a service for free on the internet, and surveilling your users and selling their data to advertisers and slapping advertisers all over it. It's proven. It's been hyper successful for the big tech companies. Google has become, you know, one of the most valuable companies in the world off the back of that. Facebook has as well.
Our investors up and down Sand Hill Road, which will throw money at you.
Yeah, it is like the most obvious, easy business model ever. Now, for the first time ever, because of Bitcoin, there is a path to charge your customers directly for services, give them a product that is compelling and reasonably priced, and make a reasonable living off of that cash flow, or off of that sats flow, off of that Bitcoin cash flow. But it is the harder path. And particularly if you want to go the most ethical approach and the most freedom-focused approach, that also usually involves open sourcing your entire stack. And so like I think what we're going to see is something similar to Bitcoin adoption in general, which is you don't see the successful incumbents do the transition. Some of them might, you know, say one thing and do something completely altogether and completely different, like actions speak louder than words, and they use it as a marketing message. And an example of that would be something like X, which now you can pay for the product, but he's still surveilling you and selling all your data to advertisers in the primary.
Fully KYC.
But not only that, like the primary business model remains the ad model. Like
you are the product.
And it's a closed ecosystem, and you need to have an account to view stuff, and the API is locked down and all this other stuff. But in his defense, and in the defense of Facebook, and in the defense of Google, or Apple, is they have very little to gain operating in a more open and ethical way monetarily from a business point of view. They're already the kings. So right. What will you see? You will see the challengers adopt these models first because they need to compete and stand out and try and break those network effects. And we saw that with someone like MicroStrategy. MicroStrategy was a older tech company that no one was really talking about. He was a small fish billionaire. He wasn't, you know, one of the richest people in the world. And he had everything to gain and not much to lose by trying to be competitive and adopt Bitcoin. And so we'll see that across all these different niches, I think. And so one example, at least in the social context, would be something like Primal, right? And Primal's entire stack is open source.
Mm-hmm.
Which a traditional investor would just absolutely freak out about. Because if Primal finds any kind of success, you will see copycats that literally just fork the stack and build out. But what is the argument? The argument is that Primal will be able to build a subscription revenue line and value-add service line that users will be happy to pay for, and that will be able to pay for in Bitcoin so they don't have to give up personal information while they do it. And they don't have a middleman in the process, and you don't have the additional friction or the cost that comes with a middleman. And that the brand equity of offering that type of service will give you some type of moat that even if someone comes around and creates Crimal or whatever you want to call your Primal fork, users will overwhelmingly prefer to use the one that has a strong reputation and has been around for a while and keeps shipping features that they enjoy. But it's a harder path.
No doubt. And I think it does. I'm thinking about my conversation a couple of weeks ago with Rashad Tabakawala, who's the global exec I mentioned. He's a 37-year veteran of Publicis, you know, advertising conglomerate around the world. And his remarks in his newest book, et cetera, are, you know, that trust is the brand mark that all companies need to be thinking about. And I think it goes to your point, which is if I trust Primal, why would I take a knockoff unless I'm, you know, just don't value any sort of quality of service. And I think, you know, I think about Kagi, however it's pronounced. I mean, that's been my search engine now for 2 or 3 years. I'd love to see them accept Bitcoin. I'd love to see them lose the overhead of credit card network fees and KYC. But any thoughts on, you know, that as a business model? It's just an alternative to the incumbents. You charge money for it. You are not the product. I mean, do you see much upside for that, or are those going to be few and far between?
No, I think there's significant upside, and we invest based on that belief. I mean, I think you know, so Kagi is more traditional web search, at least for now. But the real hype word right now is AI and LLMs, and twofold. First of all, one good thing we see in that is that there has been a willingness of people to pay for a reliable, first of all, there's real, like Bitcoin, there's real costs involved. Like there's significant energy and capital costs involved with building out these systems. But even a completely dystopian company like ChatGPT is charging for that product, and customers seem heavily willing to do that. Now, I think it is very reasonable to assume that there will be significant, as we rely on these products more and more, there'll be significant demand for people to want more private freedom focused versions of these AI LLM tools. And I think people will pay for them. And so the question becomes, how do you do that in a way that reduces friction as much as possible? And I think right now what that means is really probably a combination of accepting fiat payments and Bitcoin payments and giving the user the option. I mean, if you're not accepting Apple Pay, for instance, like you're going to have significant slippage in terms of, or significant reduced conversions of actually people paying for your product. But I think there's a lot of demand there. I think the meme that, you know, every good meme is based in reality, but if you're not paying, you are the product, is becoming more and more obvious to people. Now, you can pervert that because you can still pay for ChatGPT and you're the product. You can still pay for X and you're the product.
You can have it both ways, yeah.
But at least more and more people are recognizing that and happy to pay. And in a lot of ways, it's almost a signaling mechanism that the product is better because you're paying for it. And the question just becomes, what
higher
is the pricing?
Right. Well, as we wrap it up, Matt, this is a big one, but you're the guy to answer it. For those listening, watching, who may be on the fence, maybe they've got a feeling in their gut that, you know, things are not as they should be. They're curious. They're interested. A, what would you recommend they pay attention to better perhaps appreciate why it matters to move toward open protocols and freedom technologies, and what are a couple of things or places you would have them do or seek out to learn more? So why should they care? What should they look for? And what are a couple of places to get started?
I think first and foremost, I think it's impossible to be a perfect organization. But I think in terms of perspective and understanding where the need is right now and how much need is out there, it's good to track what the Human Rights Foundation is doing. They put out a lot of good materials on that throughout the world. They specifically have a financial freedom report that they put out once a week. I think it's financialfreedomreport.org, And if I got that wrong, you can find it HRF.
Absolutely.
HRF.org is like the main parent website. But they basically go through different stories around the world of why these tools matter, and where they're being effective and where they're not being effective, right? Which is a really nice perspective piece. And then the second thing is like, I'd be like, look, you know, I think you got to play around with the tools. And I know myself personally, my greatest motivation is trying my best to realize a future that is better for my children to grow up in. And I think that comes with inherent personal responsibility. And if you are a parent, you have to take that personal responsibility on for your family and make sure you're as best situated as possible, because there will be, this is not magic. This is not like everyone's life gets better. This is people who take agency of their lives will be in a better situation than those that don't. And the best way to get more acquainted and more fluent with the tools is to actually use them and play around with them. No one watches 10,000 hours of driving podcasts so that they learn how to drive. You get behind the wheel of the car and you drive, and that's how you learn how to drive. And it's the same thing with Bitcoin. It's the same thing with adjacent freedom technologies. You have to actually use the tools, get comfortable with them, make mistakes, improve your skills. And on that front, I have a webpage that I keep up to date, which is odell.xyz, that not only has all my contact information. So if you have any questions for me, feel free to reach out on Signal. I have that link there. But also a bunch of resources are linked there. A bunch of tools that I recommend are linked there. And I would just say, play around with the tools and get comfortable with them.
Wholeheartedly agree. Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate the time. It's been a pleasure. And I will look forward to doing this again soon.
Thanks for having me, sir. Likewise.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.